Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Jesse Green here at the control panels as always, and today we're having a really interesting and fascinating conversation around competitive intelligence. And I guarantee you the topic is so much more than the title might suggest. In particular, we're going to be talking about how to stay abreast of the trends in an industry, how to read the data, what data is going to be relevant, and interestingly, how to make great decisions in a world that is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, and how to really make sure that you're positioning your practice for future growth and being mindful and aware of blind spots, which could cause problems. Now, my guest today is Babette Bensusan, and she is internationally acclaimed in this space. She is the world leader. She's an academic and an entrepreneur, which is a really interesting mix because what that brings is rigor when it comes to data and analysis, as well as real-world experience in the trenches. Babette is a really fascinating human being. I enjoyed this conversation so much, and there's a rich tapestry of all the things that she shares in this conversation. If you want to find Babette, I'd really encourage you to go and check her out at mindshifts.com.au, and her work there is really fantastic, and she's got half a dozen books that she's authored, and I'd really commend them to you. She's a wonderful guest, and I really hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed recording it for you. Now, as always, you're going to want to have a pen and paper handy because there's some absolute pearls of wisdom that she shares that I know you're going to want to capture and apply for your practice. So here's Babette. Babette Bensusan, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us all the way from the Sunshine Coast today. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Jess. Delighted to be with you.
Look, I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you for a long time because you're a really interesting person. You've got an incredible background, an incredible business pedigree. And what I'm fascinated by is that you do a lot of work in the entrepreneurial space, and yet you've also got a lot of credibility and background in the academic space as well. So I'm curious to ask a bit about your background, and then secondarily, how do you manage to straddle the two of those? Because they don't seem like easy bedfellows, but you manage it.
Yeah, that's an interesting... Well, firstly, my background, just quickly, is I'm from a migrant family. I was born in Casablanca, Morocco, and we came up to Australia in the late 1950s, very late 1950s. Yeah. And I went to school here, educated, but I've also lived overseas quite a bit. So I have a bit of a international background. And in my travels and everything, I realized that the number one thing that was important was an education. So that was very strong in my background. And then once I got working in corporations, I was very blessed. I was lucky. I worked for companies like Levi Strauss, Apple Computers, when they were just starting out. So I learned a lot about business, the reality of multinationals, and also I worked for some small businesses. So I had really good grounding in business. And then I when I did my MBA, that's when I started my own business. And, yeah, so I've been running my own business now for 30 years.
Wow.
I've been running my own consulting firm. And one of the things that when I was doing my business studies, I realized that a lot of firms were making decisions in vacuums. Mm. And I shouldn't say firms. A lot of leaders and CEOs were making decisions in a vacuum, thinking, oh, well, this is where we want to go, without any research, without any insight into their marketplace. Mm. And so a lot of executives were making some pretty poor decisions. And when an executive and an owner of a business makes a poor decision, it impacts far more than their back pocket. Mm. It impacts all the people that work with them. It impacts their family. And to think that a poor decision is, oh, well, we made a mistake, big deal. Well, not quite. Not if you're going to lose your business. Or market share.
Exactly. There's massive repercussions for that. So there's a whole lot around decision making that I'd love to come to in a little moment. But specifically, as I said a moment ago, you know, academics and entrepreneurs, it's not a typical mix, is it?
No, but okay. So when I started my business, the first thing I did is I had a very clear vision of where I wanted the business to be 10 years from when it started. And the first thing I said was I wanted it to be a boutique expert consultancy.
Mm-hmm.
Very clear.
Yep.
So let me ask you, when you talk about an expert, what do experts do?
Well, experts have a depth of knowledge, don't they?
They have a depth of knowledge. What else do they do?
Well, they share that knowledge, of course. They research, they continue to learn, they continue to develop that body of knowledge and go deeper, go broader perhaps, and then share it.
Correct. And they share it through speaking,
mm-hmm.
writing books.
Yes.
All of that.
All that, which is exactly what you've done, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I did. The difference is, so what happened is as a result of the constant education, I went overseas and that's where I learned a lot about competitive intelligence. The multinationals and firms overseas that are in far more competitive markets than Australia, they tend to be much more aware of the competitive landscape. Mm. They tend to spend a lot of more money. The multinationals in particular, they have competitive intelligence units. In the 1990s, we had nothing in Australia. In 2000s, we had nothing. Now we have a couple of organizations that have got something. But we need to put certain things about Australia in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, Australia is a small market.
Yes,
we are only 25 million people. When you look at the American market, they are 370 million people.
Mm.
When you look at China, when you look at India and the EU, when you take that, they're far bigger markets than 25 million. So the competition is far more intense. So what happened is I had to go overseas to learn because there was nothing here.
Yeah.
I went overseas, I learned, I attended conferences, courses from the Academy of Competitive Intelligence, and I started to know it so well that over the years, I became a leading expert here in Australia.
Which is fantastic.
And then I learned a colleague of mine from America was coming here for sabbatical, and I always had an idea for a book. A dear professor advisor, when I was doing my MBA, I said, look, I want to do a PhD in strategy. And he says, well, what do you want to do it for? And I said, well, I want to be an expert. You know, I want to be known. I want to beat my competition. I want to differentiate from my competition. So he said, don't do a PhD. Write a book.
Write a book. And now you've written about six of them.
I have. And I co-authored them with a colleague, an American colleague. And I saw a gap in the marketplace. When I was doing my MBA, I noticed that we had to go to different books for different kinds of analytical tools to analyze a situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, wouldn't it be great if we had them all in one book, in a how-to book?
Yep.
And that's what we wrote. We wrote different books on how to analyze different issues. And we got a publisher we put a proposal to a publisher. Within less than 2 months, we got our grant and we got the contract.
Well done.
Out of New York.
This is long before self-publishing.
Yeah, there were some books that were self-published, but we didn't want to self-publish and we were going after the education market.
Mm, mm.
So we went with a very, very large publisher out of New York that attacked the education market.
Yes.
At that time. And I know, for example, today that over 100 universities in the US alone use our books as textbooks for students. I go to the US and people, you're the Babette Bensusan. I did your book. You know, I have your book. And consultants were using it, are using it. There's still analysis without paralysis is still comes up on Amazon in the top 1% of best-selling business books.
Well done, you. And look, the beauty of that, of course, is the impact. You know, there's a massive ripple effect writing the book.
Absolutely.
Hats off.
As a result of the books, they've all been translated into multiple languages, Korean, Japanese, Chinese, Russian, Arabic. They're in multiple languages. I became better known outside the country. And as a result of that, the strategic and competitive intelligence professionals gave me a meritorious award, which is the highest award you could get in the field of competitive intelligence. I think the second person to get it was Michael Porter. The first person to get it was an academic. And when I got it, one of the universities said, oh, I guess we'd better recognize you if you've been recognized internationally. And they appointed me an adjunct professor. But prior to that, I'd been teaching competitive intelligence in MBA programs, guest lecturing. I taught it in the US. I then taught it in the first ever MBA program in China to address competitive intelligence. The numbers in China are phenomenal. That's another story.
Yeah. So let's talk about competitive intelligence, because it's not a term that dentists listening to this show would be intimately familiar with. I mean, they understand the two words, competition and intelligence, but you know, when we bring them together as competitive intelligence, can you just give us a bit of an overview, I guess the layman's version of what that actually means? I think I have an understanding, but I don't want to make assumptions. But could you just walk us through what that means in practical terms?
So most people, when you hear the words competitive intelligence, hear competitors. Now, competitive intelligence is about your competitive ability. How competitive are you? Now, if you just look at one area of the market, which is your competitors, sadly, if you do that, you don't see any of the disruptors that come along. So did taxi companies who did their competitive intelligence, quote, look at Uber? Or did hotels and hospitality look at Airbnb? You wouldn't look at them because they're not your competitors.
Yes.
Okay. So what happens is competitive intelligence is a process for gathering and analyzing information in order to derive insights to support your business objectives. So if you look at the factors that impact a dental practice, your biggest competitive issue and that you need to monitor the closest is the government. Why do I say government?
Because of regulatory policy, because Medicare, they make the rules, Medicare.
The rebates.
Yep, all of that. And so they control the playing field.
Yes. So technology, how it can impact dentistry and make it easier for the patients. You've got Medicare and government legislation. So when you're looking at your competitive ability, you need to understand all of that, not just competitors. If you're looking at other dentists, forget it.
Yeah.
You're lost because they're already doing the same as you.
Well, we live in a very interesting time. You know, obviously, globally, there's a lot of things happening. But even in our small little pond of dentistry, there's a lot of change happening over the last 10 or so years. I was talking to you off air. You know, we've seen a global financial crisis. What that meant for dentists is that some dentists stayed around in the workforce longer than anticipated. People who would traditionally have retired, you know, didn't. So there's this buildup of dentists. Concurrently,
yes,
we've seen roll-ups, corporate roll-ups, amalgamation and corporatization. We've seen the influence of health insurance companies.
Forward integrating like NIB. They've now got a dental practice.
They do. And
miles.
And of course, their core product is, for the health insurance companies at least, is insurance, but it's the value add and the packaging up of all of those things.
Absolutely.
So it's a really interesting landscape in which we're operating. And so with respect to come to decision making later, but I do want to talk a little bit about the sort of data that you see other businesses look for to analyze, because there'll be people listening to this podcast, Babette, saying, I understand I need to look at data. I know that I need to use it to make better decisions. I understand all that. Now, I know that there's not one metric I can ask you for or anything of that nature. There's going to be a variety of things, but typically, when you've worked with other businesses, what sort of things might they look at?
Well, the first thing, I cannot stress this enough, is what is the decision you're making?
Yeah.
To go after a piece of data for the sake of data, well, all I can say to you guys, to anybody, is get a librarian, get her to do or him to do the research for you in any area you want, and then read it.
Yep.
But that will not help. The key thing is, what is your vision, in all honesty? What is your vision for the next 5 years for your practice? And once you've got that down, now how are you going to get there?
Yep.
Okay, so if you need to understand how you're going to get there, what are the things you need to look at?
Yep.
So I always say to people, you need what's called, I call it steep, some call it pest, some call it pestle. Social, you need to look at what's happening with your consumers, what's happening with the customer base, what's happening socially. Technological, what are the technological impacts that are going to impact your business and your business model? What are the economic issues that are happening in the country that will in turn affect the government's policies and people's incomes? What's going on? Environmental. How environmentally friendly is your business? Can you make it better? What can you do to help reduce costs environmentally? And the fifth one is political. What are the political legal issues that are happening around your business? And so, you know, for example, Medicare would be a social influence, but it's driven by politicians, government as well. So you'd want to understand these factors and how it impacts on your business. But then you need to understand other elements which belong to what I call Porter's five forces. How easy or difficult is it to set up a dentistry practice?
Mm.
Can you raise the barriers? Can the dental association do something to raise the barriers? I don't know. Suppliers. Is there a way that you can form a relationship with suppliers?
Mm-hmm.
What's a substitute for dentistry? I don't know.
Well, we're seeing some of that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's so many threads that I'd love to pull. I feel like a kitten with a ball of twine. I just want to pull every little thread and see where it leads us. But I'd like to just come back to the social elements for a moment, because I think I'm curious to ask you, and I'm not sure if this is within your lane, but I'll ask nonetheless, is are there any particular social trends, changes as consumers that you've observed that might be worthwhile just thinking through? Because I'm noticing some changes, but I don't know if it's anecdotal and I don't know if there's data to support it.
When I started working in strategy, there were two things that I did. The first one is I read a fabulous book called The Popcorn Report,
mm-hmm.
written by a woman called Faith Popcorn, based out of New York. Now, Faith Popcorn does what's called psychographics.
Mm-hmm.
Psychographics is understanding the psychological issues that are going on in society.
Yeah.
So her first book was The Popcorn Report, and then she wrote another book called Clicking later on. And what she's highlighted was 16 trends, social trends that occur in society.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote these books in the late 1900s, and she said, these are 10 trends or 16 trends that will happen in the next 20 years or 10 years. She's been spot on every one of them.
Wow.
And she was way ahead of her time. So one of the trends that she did was called living vicariously. And she said that there would be an increase in reality TV. Now, you've got to remember she wrote this book in 1989, 1990, the first one.
Yep. Wow.
And she also said 99 lives, that we'd be living 99 lives.
Okay.
Running from one thing to another, to being something, to doing something.
Yep.
You know, and then she said there was the vigilante consumer, the environmentalist that's going to say, no, we need products. This is a woman who predicted all these trends before. She said she predicted the issue of, oh, that's right, her favorite one that I love was called cocooning. Cocooning is the world is so overwhelming with war, with terrorism, with everything, that we will cocoon in. It's going to become harder to make friends. Mm. We will cocoon into our own group. And as a result of the cocooning, what we will tend to do is renovate rather than move. We'll want to stay in the same area if we do move. Hello, love it or list it. Selling how you look at stuff today.
Yeah.
And this is a woman who predicted things 30 years ago of this is what would happen. So I stay in touch with what she looks at future trends. She has a business called The Brain Reserve. And if you can follow that, that'll give you some cutting edge, really truly cutting edge things about trends. The other thing I do is join the World Future Society. They're based in America. Mm-hmm. It's www.wfs.org.
Okay.
And they also look at the future trends, what's happening, and keeps you abreast. Because this is where the future lies. It's not. And the trends, you've got to remember, a trend takes 10 years mm-hmm. to come through.
Yep. And there's that great saying, it's an investing saying, but I do think it translates into business as well, that the trend is your friend in the sense that you can try as much as you like to push against it, but inevitably it gathers a certain head of steam and if you don't go with it, you run the risk of being run over by it.
Well, let me give you a case study that I did with a large American pharmaceutical, a multinational. Mm. They asked us to look at their competitive environment here in Australia and where we saw things, what were the driving forces? So there's a great analytical tool called driving forces analysis mm-hmm. that I love using. So anyway, they asked us to do some analysis of trends, exactly your question, Jess. And lo and behold, this was about 15 to 18 years ago, and 15 years ago. And we said, look, we think the GPs are going to get more and more overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And I think there needs to be, we think that pharmacies or pharmacists need to pick up the backlog.
Yep. Wow.
To start picking. This was 15 years before it was, and this was the, it was there. The signals were there. See, the thing about competitive intelligence, nothing happens to you in a vacuum.
Yeah.
There are always signals. You know, the cab companies Uber didn't come up overnight with the thousands of drivers.
No.
One minute they were there, next minute they were 1,000 drivers. It took time. What was the taxi union doing? Nothing. Airbnb, do you think it happened overnight?
Of course not.
Amazon and deliveries, drone deliveries, electric cars, do you think it's happening overnight? It's not. So what makes you think that the impacts on your business are happening overnight? They're not. It's what you said earlier, that sometimes people stick their head in the sand.
Well, it's so true. And that's what I was just going to say is we can no longer afford to just assume a business as usual approach. We're going to get wiped out or at least get a significant setback. So, again, we've got to keep ourselves alert to the changing landscape, look at the trends, understand those sorts of things. I do want to talk a little bit about competition versus competitive intelligence. And this is coming to a question I asked you off air, which is around as dentists, we sometimes think of ourselves as professionals, or we do think of ourselves as professionals, not sometimes, we do. And there is a collegiate environment. And yet I spoke to you about a collegiate environment on one hand and a competitive marketplace on the other and how they do or do not coexist. And I know you have a view on that. I'd love to hear it because I think it's a really important point.
I think collegiate competition is an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Okay, to start off with.
I agree.
I think that you have competition, but there is a difference between competition, collegiality, and I'd like to add greed.
Mm.
So let me do an analogy. When you go to a watering hole in Africa,
yeah,
the lions will drink from the watering hole, as will the antelopes, as will the zebras, as will the giraffes, as will the ostriches.
Yes.
They are all cooperative, collegial, to drink from the same water.
Yes.
But when the lion is hungry, God damn it, it's going to go after that zebra.
Yeah. And that's what happens.
Yeah. And it's going to go after the antelope. I'm sorry.
It's really interesting. I've got this image of David Attenborough in my mind as we're having this conversation. And I've got this picture and vision of all the animals around the waterhole. And, of course, it does happen. But then, of course,
they're all there around the waterhole.
Yeah.
But when a lion is hungry, when an animal is hungry,
it's going to eat.
It's going to eat.
Yep. Yep.
So I understand competition.
Does this come back to self-interest? Does this come back to the human condition of self-interest? Or is that an unrelated topic?
No, I think essentially you're going to hate me for saying this.
No, it's the same.
I think self-interest exists for those who are lacking emotional intelligence.
Oh, okay. Tell me more about that.
I think the more emotionally intelligent you are, the more conscious you are of how we are all interconnected. The less emotional intelligence you have, the more you have self-interest.
Okay.
Because there's no connectedness to anything.
No, that makes sense.
So think of it on a scale. Low emotional intelligence, high emotional intelligence. Low emotional is self-interest. High emotional intelligence is the connectedness in all of us.
So do you think, and I absolutely understand your point, I'm just going back to the lion metaphor.
Yeah, because go on.
When the lion's hungry, the lion's going to eat basically and he's going to push the antelope aside and devour it if he can, right? So if we take that into the business sense though, where does the emotional intelligence and the desire or the need to put food on the table intersect?
Okay. So.
This was not at all what we thought we'd talk about, but it's a really interesting conversation nonetheless.
It is. I don't know where it intersects with humans. We know where it intersects with animals, but I think it's about values that we hold.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want, someone might say, look, I'm happy to have a Toyota Prius because it's or a Tesla because it's economically, environmentally friendly and I want to help society. But someone will say, well, I don't care. I want a Ferrari.
Yeah.
And it comes back to how emotionally intelligent.
Or someone might say, I can't afford a Tesla because it's expensive and therefore I'm going to buy a Toyota Corolla, right?
Or a Toyota Prius. Go on.
Well, a non-electric car, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So can we really judge someone for making that economic choice? And I don't think we can, right? I don't think we can.
No.
And I know that that's not what you're suggesting, but I'm just interested to explore that competitive tension and collaboration at the same point.
There is, look, I've worked with so many multinationals. I've worked on so many. There's no such thing as a merger.
Yeah.
Mergers don't exist. One acquires something. The other.
Yeah, yeah, indeed, indeed.
So when you're talking about collegiate behavior, I tend to really go down the emotional path of intelligence, emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So in negotiation, a successful negotiator will try and find some commonality between themselves and the other party.
Yes.
That to me is collegiate. That's high emotional intelligence.
Yes.
But problem is that most people, when they go into a negotiation, it's I win, you lose.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. That's competition.
Yep. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah.
So it's very hard to generalize, which is wonderful in a way because none of us are the same. We're all different.
And you know what? I actually really love that because one of the things that drives me bonkers in the world is broad brushstrokes. I think there's so many shades of gray, so much nuance, so much subtlety. And it's just, look, it's an interesting thought process. I do want to just shift gear for a second because we've touched on the fact that the world is a changing place. So we've spoken about the changing market environment. And when I was I have a background in the Navy as a dentist, and we used to use an acronym, which I know you're familiar with, the VUCA.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wish all companies would get used to VUCA. I cannot tell you how many strategy workshops I have done in the past 12 months. And I say, well, how are you to a senior executive? And I say, how are you coping with the VUCA world? And they go, what?
Yeah. I know. So volatile, uncertain, complex. Uncertain,
complex and ambiguous. Ambiguous,
right? So it's shifting sands, lots of things happening, and it's not an easy thing. So I wanted
I just wanted to say, this is what gets me.
Mm-hmm.
when you think of companies and businesses, I know the dentists who listen to this run their own practices, but think about it. Here you are, you've got these large corporations running these big practices all over the place. And it's extraordinary that the largest organization on the planet, the military, has completely changed the way they fight.
Mm-hmm.
They fight now with small, sharp units. They go in for a particular purpose, a particular vision, hit, target, out.
Yep.
Guys, this is the way organizations are going to have to move and operate the same way. This is how you work in a VUCA world.
Well, it's really interesting you bring this up because you recommend, no, this is really good, but you recommended a couple of books about the Popcorn Report and so on. And one of my favorite books is called Teams of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal.
Right.
And interestingly, it's a really fascinating book. And as a military person, yeah, I find it really super fascinating. But the story he tells is when the Americans went into Afghanistan, they were getting their backside handed to them by the Taliban, which to all intents and purposes were undermanned, under-resourced and so on. But they had a really agile and fluid cell-like structure that enabled them to do exactly what you've just done. They've gone in short, sharp and out.
But even the Israelis were the first to use that.
Yeah.
You know, elite teams, short, sharp, in, pull out. They did that with where they got the boats, where they, a whole heap of stuff.
Yeah. So it's interesting though, isn't it? Because that model, I think I think it's a really interesting way that organizations will need to restructure as well. So again.
Oh, totally agree with you, Jess. I think, but one of the things I do want to share with your listeners is the word VUCA into the terms of leadership.
Mm.
And VUCA, as we said, was volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Yes.
In terms of leadership, which is what everyone who owns a business needs to have, they need to remember the acronym VUCA.
Yes.
But from the perspective of vision, understanding, clarity, and agility.
Love that. That's a wonderful reframe.
That's
I love
VUCA.
It.
So it's not mine. It's out there.
Yeah.
I've come across numerous papers on it. It means that leaders in a VUCA world need to have vision, understand where they are and the people around them and their teams, clarity on how they're going to do it, and agility to move if things change.
So that's.
And when you look about the little army forces now that go in, special teams, that's exactly what they're doing. They've got a vision, understanding of where they go, what's going to happen when they get there. They've got clarity of what they've got to do in their roles, and they've got the agility to improvise if needed.
Yeah. So let's just talk about that, because particularly around the agility and improvisation. And again, you've got to remember most dentists have not had classical business training. Most dentists have gone through their university program, become good technicians at what they do. If you were to offer a few little words of wisdom around being able to respond in an agile manner, what sort of thoughts or advice might you offer someone in small business typically on that?
Definitely. The key advice I would give anybody, any leader in a small business, whatever, get a coach.
Yeah.
Get a good business coach, not a financial planner, someone who is accredited with the International Coaching Federation, number one. They've got to be accredited with the International Coaching Federation. Number two, they've done a proper certified coaching program,
mm-hmm.
and they've got the business and the coaching, or they've got the coaching expertise.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, it's you want someone who can walk beside you as you learn to move your practice in the vision and direction you want it to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So,
and challenge. And the key thing is to challenge the biases, your blind spots, your assumptions, the limiting beliefs you have around your practice.
Ah, the blind spots. There's a whole podcast in blind spots, isn't there?
There's a whole podcast. Look, I can tell you some stories of companies that were so blinded. Kodak.
Oh, my God, yes.
Nokia.
Yep.
Okay.
BlackBerry.
Yeah. Billion-dollar companies, Jess.
Yep.
Where are they? It's not that the individuals are greedy or unkind, those CEOs, they were just, they had biases, they had blind spots.
Maybe they needed to engage in a bit more competitive intelligence.
Well, the thing is, let me tell you a story. Kodak did, but their focus was returned to shareholders. The board and the CEO was all about looking after shareholders.
Mm.
So they focused on the cash cow.
The film.
Bingo.
And they invented the digital camera, didn't they? They had the technology.
Sure did.
They had the prize.
What it was is that in light of what was going on, they made a call.
Mm. So let's talk about decision-making in a volatile and uncertain, complex, ambiguous world, because that is hard, right? Because you can't connect the dots forward, as Steve Jobs says in his Stanford address. You can only connect them looking backwards. So how do you try to make the best possible decisions when you don't have all the information and you're uncertain about what's going to happen? And how do you minimize risk in those environments?
Look, it does come back to getting competitive intelligence.
Yeah.
It really does. And there are ways of doing it, you know, in easy, non-difficult ways.
Mm.
I'm happy to help dentists who really want to grow their practice and do things about competitive intelligence. And if you like, Jess, and if there's a need for it, I'm happy for us to do some webinars on how to analyze their environment and get the insights and to just maybe do a couple of webinars on competitive intelligence for dentists.
That'd be great.
Yeah, happy to do that.
Thank you.
With people. The key thing is, I come back to it. Where do you want your practice to be 5 years from now?
It all comes back to that, doesn't it?
It comes back. If you're not clear on the decision you're making, I'm sorry, that there's then whatever you get's fine.
Yeah.
And there are ways of doing it. There are some fabulous librarians out there that are called information brokers these days. Mm. They know how to search the internet. They know how. There is nothing out there that you cannot find.
Mm.
So to tell me that you're operating in a vacuum of no information, I know that looking in the right place.
Yeah.
For example, everybody Googles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Try Googling a certain term. Now, I want you to then go to another search engine called DuckDuckGo and Google and look for the same term. And do you know what will happen? You'll get completely different results.
Mm.
Completely different outcomes.
Wow. Wow.
Same search. They're different search engines. The same if you go to Bing. You'll get a completely different result.
Mm.
See, and Google is dangerous from my thoughts, my perspective. And I use Google incognito so that I can't be tracked on the web. Because what happens is you've got to remember all these search engines, everything is an algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you typed into Google in the previous searches that you've done for the past 4 years, 5 years, that algorithm will now bring up what it thinks you want rather than a carte blanche of what is available.
So there's confirmation bias basically in there, isn't there?
But Google, of course Google is confirmation bias.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an algorithm.
Yep.
What do you think?
Yep.
So it's going to give you what you've searched
previously,
and what you looked previously and what you like. So I'll bring it up. DuckDuckGo doesn't do that.
No, okay. That's interesting around. So coming back to the social trends, going back to Miss Popcorn, interestingly enough, I'm sure that she's probably got something in there in one of her trends around polarization of the community as well, because that seems to be happening quite a bit. You know, there's an us and them.
She called it cocooning, where you cocoon inside.
Yeah.
So as a result of the cocooning, she predicted in that there'd be more home delivery for food, home renovations, tighter communities.
Well, yeah, so what I'm thinking about, though, is the algorithm with the confirmation bias and the social impact that that has on a massive scale, in the sense, you know, you have the people who see the world one way and then you have the people seeing the world polar oppositely, and there's this divide.
There's some scary books. Have you read Sapiens?
No. I've seen it in the bookshop, and every time I go to pick it up, I think, oh, I should read it, but will I read it? And then I haven't. But I'm told it's a fabulous read.
It is. And I'm reading his second book called Homo Deus.
Yes, I've seen that too.
And that is...
Yeah. I feel like I've read... I feel like I'm living through 1984 Orwell's book sometimes.
I know.
Anyway.
But do read Sapiens. That will, it was fabulous. The author, Hegel, no, Harari, yes, he's a professor of history at the University of Jerusalem. And it's interesting. It is a history of the Homo sapien race. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And Homo Deus is us going forward.
Yeah.
Because now, we, with AI, we have in fact become gods.
Oh, goodness me. Okay. That's that. Now, there's another podcast right there as well. Babette, I do want to ask you a little bit about leadership and leveling up, because you've had the opportunity to work with some incredible businesses over the years, and you would have seen things go very well and you would have seen things go quite poorly, I imagine, from time to time.
Yes.
So as we, you know, round out our conversation today, I wanted to just acknowledge the fact that as business owners, we've all got a responsibility to improve our leadership all the time. You're constantly growing in that area. And I, for me personally, I see that as a precursor to business growth. Mm-hmm. So in your observations and in your experience, what traits have you seen that are common to the leaders that you really respect and admire? And equally, what things have you seen go awry?
I think that that's a really hard question. A good one, Jess, but hard. Mm-hmm. The good leaders that I've come across are the ones who tend to listen, acknowledge that they don't know everything, yet are well-read, are humble, and those that make the biggest mistakes are those with the egos that believe they know everything. I always think of a saying. In my coaching practice, I use a tool called the Energy Leadership Index. Mm-hmm. And the Energy Leadership Index is a way, is a brilliant, brilliant tool developed by a psychologist out of New York, which looks at whatever you think, you will feel. As a result of what you feel, you'll then behave in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But it all starts with your thinking.
Yep.
And he said that there are seven levels of thinking or that create the energy. And as a result of your thinking, you will draw particular things to you. Okay. So levels one and two, he said, are catabolic energy. And that is energy that's draining, resisting, limiting, all those kind of things.
Yep.
And energies three to seven are fueling, growth-oriented, creative, and all of that. Sadly, the world we live in is level two, and most of businesses are level two. And level two, the key thought at level two is, I win, you lose.
Yeah, yeah.
And we discussed this with competition.
We did.
Good leaders, the best leaders I've worked with, come from either a level four or a level five. And the key thinking at level four is you win. So it's how can I be of service? How can I help you? Level five is we all win or no one wins.
Mm.
And the classic is, when you think about it, is something that Nelson Mandela did when he ran for president. He said, we either pull together or Africa will lose.
Mm.
And he worked on that. Mm. How do we all win? So if you want a good leader, for me, a good leader is someone who says, how do we all win? How does his entire team win? Mm. How do the customers win? How do the suppliers? How do we all win?
Mm.
Because if we don't all win, we all lose. No one wins.
I think that's a really really powerful thought. And it's also one that is not going to be answered by glibly just thinking about it at a surface level. I think that's going to require a lot of deep thought. Yeah. A lot of deep work involved in that one.
Yes.
Babette, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, and I'm really grateful to you. And your insights are really profound. They're really interesting. I have a feeling I could talk to you for hours on end, because there's lots of conversations that I really would love to have with you, and hopefully we can come back and have those another time. But for now, from all of us here at The Savvy Dentist, I want to say thank you once again. You've been really generous, really kind, and above all else, really wise, and thank you.
My pleasure, and thank you very much. And if I can be of service to any of your listeners, please, I'm more than happy to help out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.